it was very fascinating to me that the church to which I go has a black pastor by the name of Lonnie Branch. And one day, a year or two ago, when the hymnal was out, just barely, he said to me, "There is one psalm in there, one psalm in the Bible that they left out this time that I wish they'd have left there." And I didn't think too much about it. He says, Psalm 137. And I looked at the psalm and thought about it. And there is a kind of a trace of our own, perhaps, lack of sensitivities to certain kinds of issues that might have accounted for the fact that it was left out. But I can see why, because it has some strange kinds of sounds at the end, and I want to read that psalm to you. This is Psalm 137. It's one of the very few psalms that we know exactly when it was written. Listen to it very carefully. "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom, in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof, O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed. Happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones." That's quite a song. And some years ago, before I began this kind of thinking, I set it to music, or set a form of it, and maybe we could sing that song now. And look at it here. And those of you who came in new, if you'll position yourself so that you can see that screen, you'll help yourself a lot. We'll be using it on occasion here. This is a Latvian melody. Can you see it okay, everybody? This is a Latvian melody, and the Latvian people came in the wave of refugees right after the Second World War. And I was in a parish then, and I brought several of them to America. And they taught me this folk melody, which was a haunting melody. And later, I decided to set a psalm to it. And Psalm 137 just seemed eminently appropriate for those who had fled from Russia's armies, to come finally to America. A very pathetic group of people, even till this day. And this is the way the song goes. It's a folk song called Kastiatari Kaziadaya Metalitas Vahara. So, "By the Babylonian rivers, we sat down in grief and wept, hanged our harps upon a willow, mourned for Zion. That's very easy, so how about singing along with me? "By the Babylonian rivers, we sat down in grief and wept, hanged our hearts upon a willow, mourned for Zion when we slept. There are captors in derision did require of us a song. So we sat with staring vision, and the days were hard and long. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange
let thy cross be benediction for men now in tyranny. By the power of resurrection, loose them from captivity.
Now it's a haunting melody, and it expressed, for my understanding of what was happening in the world, something of how a people must feel who are under the tremendous tyranny of a power that is so overwhelming that there's no way that you can think humanly of what can be done about how that power is exercised. You're helpless before it. And that was something of the feeling of the Latvian people. Now, at the same time, a friend of mine by the name of John Illesacker came at this, and he saw the experience in other eyes. He's a younger fellow than I, and when he provided this setting, another kind of experience of captivity came to mind for him, and he set Psalm 137 to Motherless Child. And I just passed out a sheet, or set of sheets, and on the back of the first page is his arrangement of Motherless Child, and I passed it out before the rest of you came. Could some of you who are sitting beside each other with copies pass those to people that might not have them? On the back side, Psalm 137, and this is the way it came out for John Illesacker.
By the waters of Babylon, there it was we sat down, west, and on the willows we hung our lyres, for there our captors said, sing us a song.
Second verse.
How shall we sing the Lord's song in this land if I forget you, Jerusalem? Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember Jerusalem. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child
more. This catches for American people the pathos of living in captivity. This psalm is deep in our own psyche someplace, even though we were on the top side as a group of people, as whites, it still impresses us deeply, the experience of black people. And it's a powerful expression of this psalm. Now, I read this psalm before some of you came in, but those of you who heard it, what would you say about the faithfulness of either of these two songs to the psalm? Was it accurate totally?
I found it quite accurate.
Yeah.
I have it over.
You were late and okay. Yeah. Read it through to the end. How would some of the rest of you?
It doesn't
have the end. Yeah, we both we both missed that. I think not so much missed it, but we didn't know what to do with it. Either of us. It's a terrifying kind of ending. And let me read that to you one more time, because those of you who are late can't get the force of it until you hear it. These are the last verses of it. If you have the psalm before you, it's in the seventh verse of the 137th psalm. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stone. You know, it's a chilling kind of curse, in a sense. This is one of the psalms of malediction, sometimes we call it. And frankly, you know, I don't know what to do with it. And a lot of commentators that write about it, well, they say this is not in the spirit of the New Testament. And to some degree, that's true. Nonetheless, I really feel that maybe... maybe we ought to hear it in this day and age, that it ought to impress us as something that we haven't listened to enough in the Psalms, and there are several Psalms that are this way, because there's something there that we need to do some deep soul searching about and deep reflection about. And I got into this even more when I tried to write a song for Obadiah. Have you ever heard a sermon on Obadiah? I haven't either. I've never preached a sermon on Obadiah either. In fact, it's one of those books you really don't know what to do with when you come to it. It's the shortest book, or one of the shortest books in the Bible. It's the shortest book by far in the Old Testament. Very short. And I had more or less said to myself, I'm going to write a song for each book. And here I come to this one, and I really, you know, just looked at it and looked at it. One commentator who wrote about this little book called it The Hymn of Hate. Well, you know, what are you going to do with it? Well, let me show you something of how it came out as I look at it. I'm not saying it would come out this way for everybody. Obadiah, in deepest anger, rage, 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 when sister nation joins in the slaughter, rage, rage, rage. Edom, you'll be done as you've done. All your wise men gone from Teman, blind you are to coming lostness, plucked from out your mountain fastness. Cry our curses from our slavery, rage! Whether I can sing that one again or not, I'd like for you to try it. I want to see whether these songs are even singable. Sing it with me, and it's a passionate song. Obadiah, in deepest anger, rage, 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 when sister nation joins in the slaughter, rage, rage. Your wise men gone from Teman, blind you are to coming lostness, plucked from out your mountain fastness. Cry our curses from our slavery, rage. Let me try it one more time. I know it's a little odd in the way of how it's put together, but I want you to get into the song just a bit more and maybe feel the rage just a bit more.
Obadiah, in deepest anger, rage, rage, rage. When sister nation joins in the slaughter, from our slavery, rage!
I think that's Obadiah.
Yes.
I don't think I'm missing what was said there. And it's again, like the last part of Psalm 137, a very chilling moment. And I guess, as I think about it, and I get closer to what the world is like, I think that it's important that as a Christian, I hear that rage that runs deep in the currents of those that are oppressed in other nations. If I don't, I run in danger of being so completely surprised by what's happening in my world that I can't get it straight at all. I think, as far as I can see, and I'm making a judgment here that probably is way too superficial, but we do not understand what is happening in Iran because we don't know our own scriptures, because we haven't felt into what our scriptures say at certain points, that there may be people who suffer such indignities and such terror for so many years. And rightly or wrongly, I think somewhat rightly, blame it on the powerful nations, blame it on a country like the United States, and rage for years and years. And then it breaks open with just all kinds of uglinesses that we can't understand, and we say, why me or why us? And we haven't understood how when you pull the ropes of tyranny tight, and in a sense, we were responsible for the Shah and what he did, and Savak and the secret police, and terror that was in the streets for decades. And now it comes. It doesn't come with all just every righteousness measured out the way it should be. There are excesses there. I'm not in any sense apologizing for the Ayatollah. And in his actions, he has to stand before God in the judgment along with all the rest of us. But to say and to understand why that might have happened and to feel in some way or another that rage, that I think American people just have to get into their understanding, because I don't think that's the end of the road for what's happening in the world, in our history, in our contemporary time. It's only the beginning. As nations become more and more able to disengage from a whole system that's held them in tyranny, sometimes a more gentle tyranny, sometimes a greater one, the same kinds of responses are very likely to happen unless we can figure out another way of our foreign policy that will ally us more and more with people rather than with a stable government which translates over and over again into dictatorship, dictatorship, dictatorship all over the rest of what is called, ironically, the free world that we govern in Western Europe and Japan. Now, I think, in other words, to get to an understanding of our world, we do not move away from the scriptures, but we move more deeply into the scripture to understand it. And it seems to me at this point that these two passages, and there are a number of others, speak to that depth of emotion that's really hidden as a reservoir, not only in that time, but in our time. You see, I didn't really explain to you, suddenly it's an awakening. Edom was a little country on the border of Judah, the little nation, When Babylon came to destroy it, they ringed the city and lay siege to it for several years and finally succeeded. And then some of the people of Judah escaped. Of course, it must have been a tragic thing, their city burning, and they're running from the Babylonians and go down into Edom, which is a mountainous region, which would have been an ideal place to hide out from the Babylonians. But instead, this little country of Edom turns them over to the Babylonians. And so this sister nation, this little country that for centuries had been beside them, betrays them, right along with everything else that's happened. And so this cry of outrage, of this curse that comes out of that kind of situation.
Aren't you mixing up religion and politics?
Well, I never could quite get them separated, I guess. I'm afraid that religion has a lot of political implications. I guess the best illustration for me was a rather humorous thing that the Pope said when he went to Poland. He said, "This is not a political visit." And it was an ironic statement. He went there and he did religious things. But all kinds of symbolism was underneath the surface, and perhaps it has something to do with the mounting spirit in Poland that's contrary to Zurek and the whole situation there. So there were political implications. I think that there's value in the separation of church and state in America, and I'm not in any sense trying to belittle some of the things from which it sprang, which were demons of the European experience with the established religion. I'm not for an established religion here. But I do think that it's very very awkward off and on to say that there are not political implications in religious things. And the Ayatollah is perhaps the best illustration of how religion and politics can get all mixed up. Not very well in that case. But I just don't think that it's quite possible. Even the statement of, say, Mennonite people, that they will not fight in war and they will live very quietly in their own little communities, has political implications, and the nation cannot abide these people and throw them in jail and everything else, because in some way or another they're a foreign body in this nice homogenous thing that we want in our country. So that's my immediate response. This is a subject in itself, and you've already spoken to that to some degree earlier in the week. But it's a very good point. Any other questions? This is very fundamental, and I hope that you will. Okay, Mr. Johnson.
Well, when you look at what Jesus raged against, it was mostly the religious establishment.
There was
Jerusalem, his mourning over Jerusalem and his cleansing the temple had not much to do with the Roman Empire or the political system. His rage was generally over the church or you didn't call it the church, but the religious people who were not being true to the faith.
That's very true. And woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, there are maledictions that he tosses at them. No doubt about that, but it is something that we Christians don't reflect on enough, that he was crucified on a Roman cross. And with all the story of Pilate, I think there is a certain kind of irony and a certain kind of flipness about that man, that it was a convenient thing that the religious people brought Jesus to be crucified, but he was not averse. And that ironic thing he put across on the top of the cross, "Behold the King of the Jews," in Latin and Greek and Hebrew, so that it would be very clear, this is what happens to anybody that makes any pretense about being a king, is over against the King Caesar in Rome. So it was a political act as well. We just don't get that dimension quite as much because we haven't reflected, I think, as much as we might. In fact, who is the fellow that's done those very fine translations? Jordan, Clarence Jordan's translations of Scripture talk about the cross as being a lynch pole. That as the white people of the South lynched the black to show that they were the power, no matter what anybody thought, the cross was the Roman way of saying, we rule, and don't you forget it. And in 70 AD, they ringed Jerusalem with crosses all around. And whenever they came to a place that had been rebellious, that's the way they showed that place who ruled. The cross was the symbol of everything Roman. and of Rome's method of dealing with anybody that got out of line. So it was a political act too, this crucifixion. And I think there's been a restoration of that understanding in our own time, because we can easily get into some kind of naive notion that that Roman government was really quite law-abiding and quite concerned with the rule of law in that country of Palestine in those days, when in reality Palestine was a little Vietnam going on during that era. It was in rebellion constantly, and a lot of different little brush fires, which finally broke out to the rebellion of 66 to 71 when Jerusalem was destroyed. So it was political as well.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I really think that there's something above and beyond politics, and I think that that's what he was more concerned about.
Well, I think that there are dimensions that one has to see, but I don't think it's never at the expense of that situation which it dramatized, the cross did. And I don't think we dare pull them apart, as we frequently have done. In fact, the very irony of the cross as our chief religious symbol loses some of the sense of it if we don't understand what happened to it. That here was this instrument, like a lynch rope, how a black person feels about the lynching rope. You can imagine their horror of it, their anger at it, everything. That's what the cross was. And to transform that into an object of love is something of the tremendous, mind-blowing kind of turning around that happened because of Jesus coming. So we have to keep that dimension in mind, or we miss the power of what the cross represented, that he took the very, very symbol, the heart of Roman power, and he said, you have no power over me, and I'll show you. Take your worst, the worst instrument of torture that you can think about, and I'm going to show you it's nothing. Now that's a political act as well as a religious act. I sympathize with what you're saying, and yet I think in some way or another Christians who pull back from the political issues, and we tend to, if we separate these two things out too much, lose therefore a voice in the kinds of things that need to be done. Right now our voice in what is happening nationally in many, many places needs a Christian response. Jim, you were going to say something.
The first time I ever came across an Obadiah type rage in my reading was Edmund Wilson's Homage to the Iroquois. It came out 20 years ago. And there was a leader among the Iroquois of the last 20 or 30 years who said there would be a great war in which the red snake, the white snake, Western Europe, the black snake, Africa, the yellow snake, Asia, would all fight. And they'd all kill each other off. And over that battlefield of dead corpses, the red snake would be triumphant, the American Indian. Cold War is an attractive thing for minority peoples, because Russians and Americans kill very few. We rage only symbolically and increase our armaments. While we rage, the minority peoples of the world come forward, even before the white snake and the black snake and the yellow snake are dead. Minority peoples here and all over the world have their greatest successes while the great snakes prance and spin themselves into inflation. But let me say this about the Iroquois. One thing about the Minnesota Indians that's kind of amusing to me, and with some of their fights, which I'm sympathetic with, they present themselves almost like Quakers and early Christians and Unitarians, nice folk. The guy among the Iroquois was really like an anthropological expert. He says that since the Iroquois sacrificed the dog, we should reinstitute the sacrifice of the dog. And so you had the Iroquois. I don't think he was greatly successful, but he wanted everything that the ancient Iroquois did. Minority peoples have a way of presenting themselves oftentimes as primitive Christians, ironically. For example, the Romans found the Celts absolutely detestable. They sacrificed their victims by putting them into trees and building bonfires, and 20 or 30 people in a large tree would be burned in that tree. The Romans stopped that. Finally, when Christianity came in the 3rd century AD, our Celtic fight against the pagans was King Arthur. Minority peoples oftentimes these days are like King Arthur, or present themselves like King Arthur against those wicked Germanic invaders, your ancestors and mine.
Yeah, we come really frequently ourselves out of, in quotes, third world situations in our ancestries. So there are places we can go in our own past psychic experience that would be related to this. I think that, again, not only to translate it beyond our shores, but it probably would be valuable to look at the Indian situation, the Native American situation, and hear, again, slowly things that are surfacing, as you're saying, where they put themselves on the table, what they're really thinking. And boy, that's a pretty jolting kind of thing. If you go to the whole things that are happening in our cities, this time in the 80s, what is it, four or five different cities have exploded. We look at it and we say it's just meaningless, but it's rage. And we don't understand rage because we don't have to rage. We sit on the top side of things. And to us, you know, the idea of keeping peace is not only something that's Christian, but really maybe someplace down beneath, it's also convenient for us to be peaceful. Because after all, things are flowing to us. That's, again, a statement of the way things really are. And it's convenient for us. So rage is there. A young woman sat in my office about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I am in a kind of an absurd situation. I am at the University of Minnesota in continuing education for religious ministries, and my first large task is to expedite, as a conference maker, 26 conferences around the state of Minnesota on battered women and the sources of family violence. This has come from a governor's conference, which initiated the whole thing, and there's a lot of ferment around the state, and I think that it's going to happen well. Not because I'm the fellow that's doing it, but because there's a lot of activity around the state of Minnesota concerning this side of family life. Now, a lot of the feminists in the city, I've lived 20 years there, and I've been involved in liberation things all through these years, but a lot of them have never heard of me. And here I am doing these conferences, and they look at me and they say, just who are you, Joe Bash? And you're a man on top of everything, you know? And so one of them came to my office and spent about 2 hours just kind of quizzing me about my views. And she every so often would toss in something of how she felt about what was happening in the world. And she said, you know, we women, and she represented, I'm sure, a certain radical section of the women's movement, but she said, we women have deep in our hearts rage. And she said, I look for violence in the streets with reference to women in America in the years that are ahead. And it was a pretty sobering kind of word. But to understand that rage is pretty much there. And you know, it's funny how it can transform people that ordinarily would be very much opposed to this. But when Boeing shuts down for a while and people are out of jobs and it looks as if nothing's going to happen there and people suddenly are at the edge of sinking into the direst kind of poverty, they can say some pretty strong rage kind of words. Once you get in a kind of situation where the contradictions that are in our systems really comes to the surface and moves at you. After a while, if you've had that drummed into you for weeks and months and years maybe, there might rise also a kind of rage. So you can see it. The Japanese, a very, very prosperous people, it's only been recently that you began to get the rage that was in their hearts at being thrown in concentration camps during World War II. It's only come to the surface now, over 30 years ago that this happened, 40 years almost. Now, that's the thing that I just think we can't shun or turn our backs on. Christians are the kind of people that ought to turn and look at anything without fear and with the knowledge that once something comes to the surface, it begins the cleansing process of confession and forgiveness that's necessary. And that's the thing that I'm sorry to say I think is not present in the Iranian situation. There is, it seems, no way that genuine confession of involvement in what happened there can be made by the American people, by its leadership. It doesn't seem that that's going to happen. And I think that's tragic. It may have been early in those early months that that could have been said, as it was said by some of our leadership, but not by the central people. It may have been that there would be a different story being written now. I don't know. Now, all of this is to say that as I've reflected on this through a number of years, one of the conclusions I'm beginning to reach is that maybe we've got to begin to understand the whole of Scripture, the whole of Scripture, as really a book of third world people. That it really came out of that kind of people and not our kind of people as we are now. And that may be such a staggering kind of thing to contemplate that it will take us a lifetime to figure that out. That really it was a book of third world people. Now, let me illustrate what I mean by this. The largest situation that Israel ever had as a people was an empire of Solomon. Now, back in Minnesota, I can illustrate this perfectly. Solomon, in all his glory, had a realm that was half the size of the state of Minnesota. Not so very large when you think about it. Washington, I looked it up a day or two ago, is about two-thirds the size of Solomon's empire. And that's a way of thinking about it. It was not really so grand. It only appeared grand to people who were third world people and remembered a much better era that was then. When you come right down to it, the people that preserved the scripture, the people of Judah, they lived in a country that was 45 miles by 45 miles. Now that just blows my mind. That's like a little area, if you took both sides of Puget Sound from Bremerton to Seattle, something like that, across the bay, and from the north of Seattle down to about Puyallup in some area there, and that's how big Judah was. Now, Rome, the empire in which this book finally came to its culmination as far as we're concerned, 6 million square miles, 3,000 miles across, and at points about 2,000 miles from north to south. 6 million square miles. And here's a little country, 1,600 square miles, a little bit more than that. That's what Judah was. Now there's a psychology of size going there. There's a difference about how you view things if your whole ethnic life is defined by a little nation. 1,600 square miles is over against 6 million square miles. You just are bound to look at the world differently. You can't help but look at it differently. And I believe that that is the very place in which the Bible came into being and was shaped, and that we had better try to say, what did that psychology of size mean about everything that's written in Scripture? Because they were not top dog people for more than about 150 years at the very most. Then they split in two, and after that they had very little potency and power at all. They only came into some power during David and Solomon's time because Egypt and Assyria and Babylon momentarily were all mixed up in their homelands and were in chaos there and had very little power to reach beyond themselves. And then they got themselves together, and about the 8th century BC, they began to sweep down from Assyria and destroyed the northern kingdom, and then later Babylon destroyed Jerusalem. And though there was a little period of the Maccabees for 150 years or so where they were independent again, this little country, basically it was all over when Rome came, and then for centuries again, it was a people, in other words, that were oppressed, and that's how the book was formed, and that's the whole underlying currents that run. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean about the way we understand Scripture? I think there are a lot of things that we have to reflect on, because it means that maybe we've got to start studying our Scriptures all over again and just get a different perspective. For instance, there's a whole different way of looking at the ocean when you're above it, in a boat or looking over from the shore, wherever, where I'd rather be most of the time. Yeah, but in the ocean, Jacques Cousteau and a whole bunch of people have been telling us through pictures in our TV screens what's under the surface. Whole societies, if you want, of fish and other kinds of marine life, exciting kind of things happening there. And we really, until modern technology enabled us, we really never known very much about what that was like. And quite intelligent kinds of fish at that, the porpoise, whales, sharks, dolphins. There are those who think they're as intelligent as we are, and a society and a way of life that's there, and we've not seen that. We're indifferent to it. We're still indifferent to it. We are doing things to that marine atmosphere or environment for those fish and other kinds of sea animals that we shouldn't do, because basically it's never been within our thought frames to consider them as part of God's creation that ought to be preserved and have a right to be preserved just as much as we. Now, there's something about the way we're beginning to see the sea and the ocean because of Cousteau that that's changing our minds and our hearts and our language, our whole way of thinking about it. You can duplicate this in a number of directions elsewhere. When peoples that have been under for a long time begin to surface, and we have to change our language. I have a hard time talking about God now because every so often I see the eyebrows of a woman go up because I've said, God, he did this, and they really are offended by this. And I think that there's something to rediscovery that we've got to make about how to talk about God in maybe some new ways so that it can give some feeling of comfort, of flexibility in our conversations. I don't know how to do that because I'm an older man by now, and I've grown so used to saying it my way that I don't know whether I can ever reestablish or establish anew a different kind of conversation. But my language has to change. That's what they're saying. And I think with some justice. It means that when I look at the surface of the water and there's a stone beneath it, you've had the experience of reaching down for the stone and it's not there because the water distorts, or maybe we're distorted, I don't know. Anyway, we can't see into the water what's there exactly. We can't locate it exactly. And in a certain sense, the sins that have led us to this sort of situation distort for us what we see in an under society that we haven't really looked at before. Now that's something, again, that has to be reflected on. How many of you read Watership Down or saw the cartoon Watership Down? It's a marvelous thing. I saw the movie. My daughter read the book and put me onto it. And I was going to get it out of the library here if it's here, but for this particular lecture, didn't get to it. But I saw the movie, and you can get a lot of the spirit of it out there. What happens is that one finds the rabbits living. And they're pretty much portrayed as rabbits live, as I understand it. That it's not a hokey kind of story about animals that act like human beings. They try as much as they can to say this is the way rabbits really are. And the warren of a rabbit, where they live, has some of the same kinds of problems that we have. The younger generation, after the warren gets too full, have to leave, but there's a good deal of quarreling and fighting among the rabbits before that happens, and then they take off and leave. And there's a little parable running there that's pretty marvelous. But on the side, you also see how rabbits look at the world they're living in. I could put this on the board, but I don't know. Maybe I should just for a second here. And let's think about some words. Here's how human beings think. And here's how rabbits think. Same word, let's say, at this point. What do we think when we think dog?
Friend.
Best friend of man. How do you think a rabbit thinks? Dog.
Enemy.
Enemy, just the opposite.
Well, this is so obvious, I'll just continue the same line, but cats, not quite as close to friends, man. but nevertheless, an animal that we've come to terms with and that's come to terms with us, and we've learned along the way together. What does this mean for us? How we look at it. And how rabbits might look at it.
Civilization helps perpetuate us, but it's threatening to the rabbits.
Right. In the story of Watership Down, what has prompted the whole thing to get out of focus for that Warren is that civilization has come and is building a shopping center there. And so it's scraping away the land, scraping away where the Warren is, and it's threatening the very life of the rabbit community. Okay. Car. Even we're having trouble with that symbol in our society now. But nonetheless, it's been regarded as a release. And I'll have to say, as one who grew up with the culture of the automobile, the solitude when you're driving gives you all kinds of possibilities for all kinds of thoughts. And to me, there's still something that an automobile has represented that was good, along with much of the evil that it represents in terms of how it's polluting our society.
There's a perfect poem from the 5th century BC Greece, and this is it. The boys throw stones at the frogs in sport, but the frogs die not in sport, but in earnest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Now, for the rabbit, what does the car represent?
Swish.
Swish, yeah. They call them in the book Rudy-doos. The Rudy-doo comes, and they don't even know what to make of it. They know it's not an animal. It's not a living thing. But it just comes impersonally, and if you're in the way, you're done. And they don't even have a way of saying in their own thinking how and what that's like. It might be a little bit like we can't completely account for a volcano and don't know what to make of that. But there's two different languages. When you're looking from the top side down, you've got one way of looking at it. When you're looking from the bottom side up, you've got another. Okay, now let's just take a couple illustrations. Let's take the illustration of the saying of Jesus, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth." That's a scripture saying. Let's look at it, if you're looking at it as it was given, and let's look at it as we, as a Christian society, might take it. If you're looking at it as a little band of not even 12 right now, but 11 men and a few women. All power given to me in heaven and earth has a completely different kind of feel about it than when I, in this American culture, with bombs that can destroy the whole earth, hear that phrase, all power is given unto me in heaven and earth. It may be that I don't hear it the same way that a third world person might. And I don't see it really as the only way I can survive. I see it kind of as an ancillary thing. It's an auxiliary thing that we are a powerful nation, and on top of it, we happen to believe right. We happen to have the right faith, the true faith. That's about the way the proportions have gone in our society after a while. That's how different it appears. Maybe the cross itself. We were talking about it earlier. We've seen it as a symbol of love, and we hold it before people, and we say, you know, believe. And the Jews say, oh, it scares the daylights out of us. You're a Christian cross. Because we know what love has really meant from Christian people with pogroms and pogroms, calling us Christ killers for centuries and centuries. It doesn't appear to us that way. And that means that we've got to reassess, you know, whether we've understood the cross. And I fully believe that we've got to go back to it as the political symbol it was along with the religious, so that when Jesus says that strange word, take up your cross and follow me, That's not exactly saying, here's a nice, safe religious symbol. He's saying, take up the very symbol of Roman power and just show it has no power over you. And the Sermon on the Mount, I think, has many things to say that way. If a guy compels you to go one mile, go two with him. He doesn't have any power over you. You're free. If he takes your coat, why give him a second coat? You know, there are all kinds of things like that. It's a way of life that indicates that there's another kind of strength altogether that you can't get to. So there are whole kinds of things that we need to think about in this third world business. And some eloquent things, much more eloquent things than I can say were said this morning in the context of the book of Revelation, just marvelous things that also go along with the sorts of things that I've been talking about. Okay.
I don't know where I got off in this line of thinking. It seems almost fashionable to be in touch with certain definitions of what this third world is and the rage that exists there. You can identify it with a small African nation or something like that, but it would seem to me, and maybe this is where some political hypocrisy comes in, we were talking about numbers and sizes, there are far more people who are in that condition than, say, the realm of what the Soviets control or the Chinese, for example, in terms of numbers. And where we preach politically about wanting to preserve personal liberty, etc. We want to tie certain things to that. We want to saw off trade with a country who doesn't allow this. And yet, in every way, we support and continue to engage with nations that are much larger and subjugate far more people. And I'm bothered by that.
Well, I don't think I'm being hypocritical about this.
I wasn't directing at you.
Well, no, I think to a degree it's a word, and I receive it, and I don't want to discount it. I am not in any sense trying to make an apology for the Russian Empire. I think it's fully as demonic in its own way. I don't want to give any notion that I would condone it, and they have their subjugated peoples, and right now Poland is making some effort to pull itself away from that kind of thing. My wife is East German, fled from the communists, so I'm not unaware of the demons that are there. I think the Chinese are another power that's rising that will have its, well, already is beginning to realize its demonic possibilities. I didn't approve their war with Vietnam. It didn't seem to make any sense to me to just go out and strike down somebody smaller than you just because they wanted to show that they were stronger. I have no... But when I'm talking as an American, it's so much safer and easier to go over with those places and spend my time talking about their evils, when in reality we have South America, most of Africa, parts of the Asian continent, Korea for instance, to some degree Japan until after a while, as our minions, and there are millions and millions of people there that really basically are patterned the way we want them to be. Through dictatorships that we support. And someplace I have to say that's an evil. It may even be doubly an evil because we pretend and use that phrase, we are the free world. And so there's a real hypocrisy there. Now to some degree, I guess I would try to dialogue with you in response to what you're saying. I have all kinds of feelings and notion that it's gonna happen to Russia just as it's happened to us. I think they're somewhat on a rising tide of power because we are an older imperial power, and our empire is splitting up before theirs. But I think it will happen.
Let me put it this way. It wasn't directed at you.
Well,
it was.
I don't mind
that. Yeah, it should have been.
No, I don't mind that. I'm very happy with
thinking
it.
I guess, in terms of what's happened in Iran, you know, until recently, I guess I didn't really think about it because I didn't know what's going on there. And I guess I'm a little troubled that I ought to be apologizing for what's happened or be responsible for it. So there's a great deal of attention directed at that in some smaller countries around the world. And if that were the only thing going on, maybe it'd be a lot easier to deal with it. But maybe the desperateness of the situation is that we are very much in a minority, and it's the majority of the world and some big parts we're not even talking about that have to be dealt with.
Okay, let me respond. Let me respond to the Iran situation just briefly. I agree that most American people, that controls our life by what we constantly put before the world as our superb gift to the world, democracy and control by the people, then we did have some responsibility for not even being aware. And the fact that so few people knew anything about this is some indication that as leaders in the world, we are not being responsible by having a lot of resources being tossed into us constantly. I think the English did better at this than we do when they were top dogs. That we can't even get a good translator in Poland when our president goes there. Somebody who really can translate between Polish and English. Where are we? As the leading nation of the earth that pretends that we are working on behalf of a lot of those kind of people. Excuse me, Paul.
No, I don't want to interrupt you, except it seems to me that people like you, who are condemning the United States rather than the Soviet Union, are not in any way denying that the Soviets have a moat in their eyes, but are rather paying attention first to what is your responsibility, the beam in our eye. It isn't that the Soviets and the other communists are guiltless, it's that we are not committing their crimes. We're not guilty of what they're guilty of. And it's just not up to us to correct their guilt. It's up to us to get the beam out of our own eye first. So that I think you're just on very strong ground to go ahead with the self-indictment. And I don't see any implication in our self-indictment that the others are innocent.
Okay,
so pointing out the guilt of the others is just beside the point.
I think I just understood your point. If we have somehow made things happen in certain other parts of the world, we have much more responsibility than what happened in Latvia or
Ukraine. If I were in Russia, I don't know. I mean, in my heart of hearts, I'd be scared silly, because I know that there's another kind of tyranny there. I think I would be among those who being sent off to Siberia. I don't know. Can't really say I have the nerve to do what those very fine, noble protesters are doing there. And I would say of the two places, I'd rather be here, because at least my voice, I can talk in a group like this, and I'm not going to be probably impaled tomorrow or something.
Well, I can see by taking care of those things that we might be or are responsible for. And by the same token, I would hope at the same point we don't write off whole peoples.
There's so much interdependency that as we move along, for instance, the one intelligent foreign policy move that we've made in recent years was with Zimbabwe. That was primarily through a guy that got a lot of bad press, Andy Young. The only reason that Zimbabwe has come out this far, it's still precarious and there are a lot of problems there, but we got through that and have kept in the right kind of position with reference to it in the main, was because Andy Young began to change our African policy and began to tell us we could no longer go with the Rhodesian government. Now that's an illustration for me of some. I'm not just saying this is a blind thing. I think there are ways that some of these things can be dealt with, and that he was beginning a much better policy toward Africa than what we've had. And I'd like to see us do that all over the place, South Africa and South America, especially in Korea. These are major sores in the quote empire that we have. Thank you. You really helped a great deal by saying what you said, and I'm not saying that that's the end of your story, and I have the advantage. I've had the hour.